This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
All of the petroleum that we free up from these products is petroleum we don't have to buy or produce ourselves. We don't have to drill for it. We don't have to go to war for it. It helps it become a direct and immediate part of the solution.
Today on Sea Change Radio, we talk with Joe Marlin, a biodiesel gas station manager in San Francisco, who thought there really ought to be a better way to fire up your summer grill. We talk about the great unexplored potential for replacing petroleum-derived products with biologically derived cleaner, greener alternatives. Later, we hear from Dan Ferber, co-author of Changing Planet, Changing Health. The book focuses on the multiple detrimental impacts of climate change. But our conversation centers on what can be done on an individual, local, and global scale to curtail the progress of disaster. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Joe Marlin. He's the fleet manager of Incredible Adventures, station master of Dogpatch Biofuels, and the inventor of BioLighter, petroleum-free charcoal lighter fluid. Joe, so good to have you on Sea Change Radio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here, Alex.
Tell us what gave you the inspiration for inventing BioLighter and how it's relevant to a wider scale.
Very good. I'd be happy to. My primary responsibility a year ago was as fleet manager for Incredible Adventures that has been doing adventure touring on biodiesel-powered vans running zero petroleum for about 8 years. We were the first company to do so in the nation. I later became the station master for Dogpatch Biofuels here in San Francisco, San Francisco's first B100, 100% biodiesel, petroleum-free diesel station.
And I should mention a sponsor of Sea Change Radio.
And I was meeting with my business partners, and we were outside, and up the street about a half a block, someone had started a charcoal barbecue. And being pretty strong in the biofuel industry already, we started to tear up, and we're already fairly in, and we're gagging, and we finish up our conversation, and I hop in a van to go pick up some furniture for our new location, and I think to myself, well, there's got to be a better way. And that was the bell. It took a couple of weeks of development, the purchase of a secondhand organic chemistry set, and a bunch of research to come up with the final product. But what I did finally come up with is BioLighter, which is a charcoal lighter fluid that works just as you would expect a traditional one, which is based on petroleum too. You squirt it on the charcoal, you drop a match, and 10 minutes later, you're grilling. But because it isn't based on petroleum, it has none of the foul smell that is associated with that. So not only does it work faster than its petroleum counterpart in the first place, but you don't have to wait an extra 10, 15, 20 minutes for that gasoline smell to burn off before you can start grilling. So it ends up being faster in that regard as well. As a result, it got us all thinking about other applications where petroleum was on the market in sneakier ways than it is in the transportation industry. We all know about the gasoline that's going into our cars, the diesel fuel that's going into our trucks, and there's a good deal of focus on what is happening with evolving technologies for bio-based fuels and alternative energies. The transportation industry has now finally gotten some focus and some traction on developing vehicles that run on these alternative energies and utilize them most efficiently. And I thought it would be a good time to start looking, you know, raise our visual horizon, look around us at the other places where we find petroleum in the marketplace as a dominant product that at this point in time, with the emerging technologies being so prevalent, could also be displaced to help reduce our dependence on petroleum.
Give us an example of some of the products that one might not expect is derived from petroleum, but actually is.
I'd be happy to. As a matter of fact, as part of my research for this project, I ran across a website where the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers has listed the many uses of petroleum. It's a one-page document in about 4 points, and it lists over 550 uses for petroleum that we just run into every day. Everything from tennis balls, oxygen masks, golf balls, the aforementioned charcoal lighter fluid, insecticides. It's even in things like bubble baths, weed killers, backpacks. So as you can see, there are a lot of things out there, and pretty much anything you run into that's plastic, which is a pretty good starting point, by the way, is going to be from a petroleum-derived feedstock.
And this piece of paper that we're both looking at, this from the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers, this is something they're proud of. They're like, look, without petroleum, we'd really be screwed. And it's a pretty horrifying list if you put it in context.
It is context-based. And as a matter of fact, I am sure they consider this a point of pride. These are bragging rights for them. But as an environmentalist, I look at this and am just appalled. But at the same time, I'm also inspired, because when in a list of 550 items, you can find quite a number of things that there is some hope that with creativity and science, putting bright minds and energy to work on them, we could displace and, again, pull a great deal more petroleum off the marketplace, use it in places where we just have to for now, and reduce our dependence on foreign oil at the same time.
Beyond lighter fluid, what would create a turning point or another light bulb moment to get some of these other type of industries' products to switch over to either alternative fuels or look for a better way? I know that in things that go on the human body, when we're always worried about our health and our children's safety and health, that's one of the big motivators to get petroleum out of our products. You look at things like mouthwash and skin conditioners and sunblock and things like that. You're seeing more and more of these products that are petroleum-free.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, there are plenty of driving forces, well, maybe not plenty, but several driving forces that are bringing all natural products to market for things like the cosmetics and the cleaning products that you're mentioning. I'd like to appeal to you and to your audience in this challenge by saying this. If you've ever had the experience of buying a new car or a new car to you, you've done your research, you've figured out what car you want, you get a brand new car, and you start driving it around, and you notice that everybody else has the same car. You suddenly start seeing it everywhere. Well, let this be your new car vision. There, I'm going to give you a few things out there that are huge in this industry that I want to bring to the front of your brain so that when you start noticing it, you start thinking alternatives and what the alternatives might be.
And when you say this industry, you mean the petroleum industry.
The petroleum industry, absolutely. So, tires. There's a lot of tires out there and a lot of tires out there that are going to waste after they are partially used up on the street. They're almost 100% petroleum based. We've got things like insecticides and fertilizers. Now, you know, there are alternative versions of fertilizers. They go back an awfully long ways. Those are the types of things that I want you to look at. Plastics. There are great emerging plastics that are vegetable based, that are direct substitutes and non-leaching substitutes for the plastics that are on the market now. We should be supporting those industries and pushing them to scale up as quickly as possible, because anything that's wrapped in plastic, some things that are unavoidable. I don't think many of us can get away without a computer these days, but good luck finding one that's petroleum-free. So look at things like the fertilizers and the tires and the insecticides and the fabrics. That's another large area where the rayons and the chiffons and the nylons have taken over the industry, whereas good old cotton was better in the first place, and now we have these phenomenal bamboo and hemp fabrics that could also start taking great chunks out of that marketplace. All of the petroleum that we free up from these products is petroleum we don't have to buy or produce ourselves. We don't have to drill for it. We don't have to go to war for it. It helps it become a direct and immediate part of the solution.
But if you get into something that has a complex supply chain, that's a much trickier beast. But you got to get one building block at a time. And before you know it, we're making petroleum-free computers or cars.
This process is called disruptive technology. It's by definition designed to pull things up by the roots that exist and chuck them out. That's why you go for the low-hanging fruit. You get the visibility, you get the immediate impact, and you get the media and public attention and awareness necessarily to go for the harder-to-reach fruit.
It's just a question of mainstreaming and getting this out to the mainstream and making the marketing departments behind Kingsford, the people who make checkers or chessboards or soap dishes or yardsticks or rugs or foot pads. These people need to start thinking that there is an advantage to having a petroleum-free symbol on there, just like you see gluten-free is emerging as a new sector because of the growing number of people who are allergic to gluten.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think the time is right now. I believe in hindsight that the environmental movement may have done itself a disservice in the late 70s and throughout the 80s in trying to push their agenda too far, too fast with early products that were labeled as green without having done the research to make sure that they lived up to the standards that people expected of them.
For example,
household cleaning products. Very early on, some were made available. And there were so many homemakers that were environmentally aware and sensitive about the health of their families that they couldn't wait for something like that to hit the market and bought it off the shelf as soon as it appeared there. But when they got it home and it didn't work, they were pretty disappointed. And that, unfortunately, set back the whole industry a fair bit. Enough time has passed and enough good, well-researched, well-performing green products are on the market and now being spearheaded by larger companies like SC Johnson, Procter & Gamble, Clorox, that with them getting behind the technologies, hopefully these things will move along more quickly. Many homemakers went out there and saw the first environmentally friendly products on the market to help clean their house and were all over the idea. They were the initial buyers because they wanted that for the safety of their family and the benefit of the environment more than anything else. And they tried them and they didn't work. Once bitten, twice shy, of course, they're a little more gun shy about getting back out there and trying the next green product that's on the market. But I think people are starting to get past that hump, and there are companies like Clorox, Procter & Gamble, and other major companies out there that are now investing in green technology. As a matter of fact, Kingsford themselves put out an invent or challenge to come up with the next best charcoal lighter fluid that doesn't involve petroleum and how it could be applied to match light charcoal.
So how can one buy BioLighter at this point?
Our master retailer is doing a nationwide kickoff campaign that starts this July 4th. In the meantime, Dogpatch Biofuels in San Francisco and Biofuel Oasis in Berkeley both have the product on the shelves. We will also have mail order available shortly at biolighterbbq.com.
Joe Marlin, he's the inventor of BioLighter, petroleum-free charcoal lighter fluid. He's also the station master of Dogpatch Biofuels in San Francisco and the fleet manager of Incredible Adventures Touring Company. Joe, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
And thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Smoking with some barbecue and hanging and swinging up every night. I read the light, the grill, then bullets and rice on Monday nights. The Tuesdays and Wednesdays is quite okay. Gonna light the grill up anyway. We smoking and we was in BBQing everything.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
My guest on Sea Change Radio is Dan Ferber. He's an award-winning science journalist and co-author of the new book, Changing Planet, Changing Health. Dan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to be on the show today.
Dan, what was the impetus behind this book?
My co-author, Dr. Paul Epstein, is the associate director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He is a physician. He is a public health scientist. And interestingly, he has moved beyond the boundaries of those disciplines to find real-world, pragmatic, real-world solutions. So over the past 15 years or so, he's worked with people in the business community. He's worked with people in the world of international diplomacy, the United Nations. He was a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And so he's worked with a lot of people to come up with practical, real-world solutions to the very large problem that climate change poses to us. But when I met Paul, he was the first person that I talked to about climate change that I left that conversation with a sense of hope, because what Paul had was a plan, a systematic, well-thought-out plan of solutions. And so that's why I got on board. And for Paul, it's been his life's work. He's been He was one of the leaders starting in the early 90s who first started making the connections between global environmental change and human health, in particular climate change and human health. And he helped educate the medical community and basically helped sound the alarm to the larger world that this was a real problem for us. And it's not just about polar bears and penguins. It's really about us and preserving a livable environment for our children and our grandchildren.
Tell us about some of the countries that you focus on in the book and some of the issues that you spotlight.
Sure, absolutely. To report this book, I traveled, so the book tells the story of Dr. Epstein's career, starting when he was a young physician working in Mozambique in the late 70s, on up to making these connections between the environment and human health, and on up to his work vetting various types of solutions. But in addition to that, what we do is we bring readers to the front lines of climate change. The goal was to tell stories of scientists, of doctors, of patients who are really wrestling with these health issues already. So I traveled for a number of places. I traveled to Kenya to report on malaria there, and I met a woman whose daughter had a life-threatening case of malaria in the area of around Mount Kenya. There's millions of people that live in that area of central Kenya, very crowded countryside. This is an area where people lived to escape malaria in part. It's high elevation, even though it's only 30 miles from the equator, and it was too cool for malaria. So in the case of this little girl who was 7 when she contracted the disease, it really was a heart-wrenching story. She got very, very sick very, very quickly in a matter of days, splitting headache, a terrible fever, and her mom took her to the hospital. And the diagnosis was cerebral malaria, and cerebral malaria kills a lot of children in Africa. That's what happens when the malaria parasites burrow into the brain. It's into the cerebral spinal fluid, the fluid that bathes the brain. And so it's the most serious form of malaria. And the mom thought, for sure her daughter was not going to make it through. And really, for a long time afterwards, it haunted the little girl. So this, it was just a story. A lot of times you hear about malaria statistics, but this is, these are real people, and there's lots of them being affected by this. And in these highland areas, the link to climate change is that in these highland areas, mosquitoes are now living that carry malaria that didn't used to live. And what's more, in the low areas in sub-Saharan Africa, people kind of grow up with malaria. Some children die from it, many do, but many survive, and they have a limited immunity as adults. But in these highland areas, you can get epidemics of malaria that can make 60% of the people in a village sick. So hundreds of people can die in these epidemics. So that is what climate change is bringing to these mountainous areas in central Kenya, western Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Ethiopia. So it's a huge health problem.
And also in the book, you talk about how some old diseases that we thought we had eradicated have reared their ugly head. You discuss Mozambique and how warming water temperatures there are leading to cholera coming back, right?
So the link with cholera is through warming water temperatures. Cholera outbreaks are also caused, of course, by poor sanitation. So with many of these diseases, there are multiple causes for something that happens, but climate change is one of them. And that was, in the case of cholera, that was a disease that where this was figured out early on by a woman named Rita Caldwell, a microbiologist. And what she did is she traced she asked the question, what happens between cholera epidemics, and found that the cholera bacteria hides out in the ocean. Also, as the oceans warm, the bacteria multiply. They hitch a ride on these tiny animals called zooplankton. And as the water's warm and nutrients from pollution are in the waters, you have these blooms of these tiny plants called, and which are eaten by the tiny animals. The storms bring them inland, and you get cholera epidemics because the bacteria is hitching a ride on these tiny animals when people drink water contaminated with this stuff. So that's the link to climate change. And also for Dr. Epstein, that was an epiphany for him. That Dr. Caldwell's work was an epiphany for him because it really got him starting to think about the connections between climate change and human health.
The things that I used to do, yeah. Lord, I won't do no more, yeah, now, yeah. The things that I used to do, baby, I'm trying to tell you, ain't gonna do no more, yeah, now. And I used to sit and hold your hand, baby, yeah, now, Lord have mercy, and cry, baby, do not go, yeah, but I don't care no more.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
My guest on Sea Change Radio is the co-author of the new book, Changing Planet, Changing Health. He's a science journalist, Dan Ferber. Dan, from a policy perspective in terms of trying to solve the climate change problem, what kind of solutions do you propose in the book?
First of all, our solutions range from things that individuals can do up to the level of international changes in the international financial architecture. It's a systematic set of solutions. But as far as things that individuals can do, we profile, for example, a couple in Illinois who put in a geothermal heating system on their house as opposed to a conventional heating air conditioning system. Cost them some money up front, but it paid itself off in energy savings in 7 years. We profile a Southern California pistachio farmer who put in small-scale wind in his orchard there. So these are things that go above and beyond what a lot of people are already doing, things like driving hybrids, driving electric cars, bicycling more, you know, driving more fuel-efficient cars with houses, weatherizing houses, and you know, putting in things like triple pane windows and all sorts of things that we can do as individuals. They're all important, planting trees. One of the things I emphasize when people ask me this question, I always emphasize the importance of engaging our policymakers, because they need to hear from people that climate change is not way down on the list of priorities. It is a top priority for people. So I would basically ask your listeners, anybody, to really keep that as top priority. Let policymakers know that it's extremely important. This is about the health of our children and our grandchildren.
So let's talk about some of the wider ranging solutions that you discuss in your new book, Changing Planet, Changing Health.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, one of the most exciting things are what towns and cities are doing. And I think the real leadership in this country is happening at that level rather than Washington, which we can talk about a little later. But in towns and cities, we have things like we have towns with climate action plans. Chicago's been a leader. They've planned, under Mayor Daley, have planted 400,000 trees in 2 decades. They train workers to install renewable energy technologies. 500 miles of bike lanes by 2015, a bike lane within half a mile of every Chicago resident. Green roofs are a trademark of Chicago. They're favoring green buildings, so giving builders who want to build them faster permits, which is a big deal for builders. They're promoting residential neighborhoods, mixed use neighborhoods that are both residential and business, to cut down on commuting time so people can live where they work. Increase mass transit use. All of these things put together, you end up with a much more sustainable community, and so that's what communities are doing. And one example I like to highlight is, because it ties into what we were talking about before, the big changes that certain people are making. Well, Cambridge, Massachusetts, some of those big changes are expensive. And what Cambridge, Massachusetts did is they said, we're gonna weatherize half the buildings in this city. And if you know, Cambridge is basically part of Boston. It's big. It's a city. And that's a remarkable goal. And they did that by coming up with a big pot of money from public and private sources The money pays to weatherize buildings. They get paid back from the energy savings over a period of maybe 5 to 7 years. And after that, the building owners reap the benefits of a more energy efficient building. I thought that's brilliant. And it's innovation on the financing level, on the policy level. So those are the things that communities are doing. On the national level, the regional national level, we need a smart grid. Smart grid powered by renewable energy. We need smart grid, meaning getting smart about our electricity use. And like when you walk out of a room and the light goes off, that's an example of a smart grid technology. And similar automation can be used at homes and factories to control appliances and whatnot. We also need most important, a policy to make renewables more affordable than fossil fuels, which is what, of course, cap and trade was supposed to do. It didn't go through. Carbon tax is another policy option. We need some sort of policy to favor renewables. We need that badly. On the international level, and this is where Dr. Epstein has thought a lot about this, and I think this goes up beyond what even people are talking about in Copenhagen and Mexico City to some degree. We're talking about coming up with a big pot of money, $500 billion a year, to do two things, to help the developing world move to renewable energy and not burn everything in sight, coal or wood, and also to preserve forests. And these are really, really important, and we're proposing changes in the international financial architecture so that these developing countries are not so desperate that they have to pay off their debt, that they have to, for example, cut down a rainforest to do it. So, the planet can't afford that. So we're proposing some changes in the international financial rules that promote equity in the developing world, a basic standard of living, because poverty is a huge public health problem. Deep, desperate poverty is a huge public health problem. Finally, we're talking about giving the authority to make grants from this big pot of money to the Global Environmental Facility instead of the World Bank, because that World Bank has been part of this system that has existed for the past 3 or 4 decades that has gotten countries into hock, and they've gotten pretty desperate about finding the cash to pay off their debt. So we want equity, we want forgive debt, and basic standard of living in the developing world. And these things can be achieved with a few changes in the rules, not big changes to the system, just a few changes in the rules. Finally, where's that money come from? So, by the way, that $500 billion has also been proposed by the International Energy Agency. So that's what we need, about on the order of what we need. It's about 1% of the global GDP. That money can come from a tax on transactions in international currency, so basically currency speculation, which happens to the tune of $2 to $3 trillion a day. So if you take a quarter of a cent on the dollar, you could come up with $500 billion. So that way countries don't have to pay up, even in a tough economy. It's difficult to get money from countries. So those are some of the national and international policy changes that we propose that put together would make a huge, huge difference in moving towards a sustainable, low-carbon economy.
Dan Ferber, the co-author of Changing Planet, Changing Health, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It was great being here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Meters, Kermit Ruffins, and Junior Parker. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.